The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Liverpool. As Tom Hicks Jr. would say, blow me. From boardroom war to high court bore, the pod is all over football's biggest story. And we ask, who is baseball bigwig John W. Henry? And will he be disappointed that Liverpool don't still have a pennant? Also today, David Kahn joins us with behind-the-scenes news from Man City, second in the league, but with tensions brewing. Tevez v Mancini, De Jong versus the Dutch. And with Euro qualifiers on the way, there's our usual high-quality international roundup. England, Capello bringing in some fresh blood. Hey, if cyclists can do it. While elsewhere, there's tough games for Scotland, Russia, Turkey, Germany, and many more. All of that plus your posts in Football Weekly Extra. Hello, listeners. On board today, Barry Glendedding.
Hello, James Richardson.
Tom Lutz.
Hello.
And Paul Doyle.
Hi.
Hi, Paul. A little bit more enthusiasm there?
Hi.
Ha ha, there we go. Excellent. And off we go, because no time to waste, eh? There's groundbreaking news, breaking ground out there, Barry. Liverpool.
Yes.
Yes. What's the latest?
They've renamed Anfield Fenway Park.
No, they haven't.
No, but they might.
Oh.
And they're still playing in Red Sox, which is fitting. Because the owner of the Boston Red Sox baseball team, or Rounders team, some American sport, has sale has been agreed to three of the board, the three who aren't Hicks and Gillette.
Have agreed a sale to... Hicks and Gillette say they fired those people, so they can't agree the sale.
That's correct, and there's now going to be a complex legal wrangle in the High Court to find out whether or not a sale has been agreed or the club can be sold to this man who owns the Boston Red Sox.
Mm. This man being John W. Henry. Is he good news?
Well, you can never figure out how good someone's going to be until they're actually there. There were a few Liverpool fans who thought Hicks and Gillette would be good, and it turned out they weren't. But I will say one thing about him compared to other owners of US sports teams in the Premier League at the moment. If you look at his history with the Red Sox, it's incredibly impressive. As everybody knows, Red Sox had a very poor history. They hadn't won the World Series for years until he came along. And he installed this guy called Theo Epstein, who looked at baseball in a completely different way through something called sabermetrics, which had been pioneered in smaller teams. And as soon as Epstein came in, the Red Sox turned round. They won the World Series. So this isn't a man who's just going to come in and throw money at a team. He might look at different ways of running a football club.
It's interesting that you say he's not a man who's just going to come in and throw money at a team, because there's this unbelievable sense of entitlement that has engulfed fans, particularly of bigger clubs, that they demand someone to come in and throw money at the team. There was even some Liverpool fans yesterday saying, we don't want an American, we want an Arab, a Russian, or a Chinese person, seemingly on the belief that these people have unlimited funds and we'll just throw money on them. And it's all very pathetic. Why should any club be entitled to have some come down? It's like kids saying, my dad should be a multimillionaire. It's silly.
Are you suggesting that Liverpool fans have a sense of entitlement? Surely not.
Well, they're not the only ones.
Well, what's quite interesting, Liverpool-based listeners, we will be in your city next weekend.
But the Red Sox are quite comparable to Liverpool in their fans have this kind of sense of entitlement. They're one of the bigger sides. This guy's come in and he's kind of handled it quite well.
And it's not just fans, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, Martin O'Neill walked out on Randy Lerner because Randy Lerner refused to keep giving him money to spend on players that he hardly ever used.
Mm.
It's silly. Yeah? There has to be a little bit of reality in, even in the Premier League.
Where's the fun in that, Paul Doyle? There's lots of people posting in on this issue. Cowdex, the John W. Henry move makes financial sense for Liverpool by combining their yearly bulk orders for Red Sox with the Boston-based baseball team. They'll make considerable savings. It's a fair point there. Turns says, as a Red Sox fan for many years, I have often been impressed by the good way the Boston club is handled. It's something that's universally recognised in the US. After being nearly men for over eight decades, they're now the most successful team in baseball. Templeton the Rat says, I see only two problems with the John Henry ownership. One, he has never been successful at getting a new stadium built. And if he does redevelop Anfield, ticket prices will probably go way up. A very interesting article, actually, I thought so anyway, by Bruce Gottesman.
over on the EPL talk thing. Bruce is a Florida Marlins fan. Now, a lot has been made of the success that John W. Henry has had at the Boston Red Sox, as in some way establishing his credentials for running a successful sports franchise. But Bruce points out that he was a complete disaster at his previous club, the Florida Marlins, where he went in with this big thing about, I'm going to build a new stadium and that's going to turn it into something really, really worthwhile. And when that didn't happen, he basically completely lost interest and, in Bruce's words, turned into Mike Ashley, selling off all the best players, etc.
But he perhaps learnt from his mistakes at the Marlins, and then when he went to the Red Sox... Mm. He learned from those mistakes and built on them. So I think it might be a bit unfair to criticise him for his...
It's just
club.
Balance, Tom. I'm just giving balance here.
Yeah.
He also has a very attractive wife who's 30 years his junior.
Right.
Which I just thought I'd throw in there.
Lovely. What's her name, Barry?
I can't remember.
I'm sure the readers can Google her.
She's on Twitter, and the two most recent Twitter pages she started following are both related to Liverpool FC, so she's going to take a hands-on interest as well.
Interest. I mean, it's all wild speculation at this moment, given the complexity of the legal wrangles ahead, what this is all going to mean for the team. In a nutshell, is it good news or bad news for the beleaguered Roy Hodgson, Paul Doyle?
Well, as I've explained, I don't know. I mean, if we operate on the assumption that the new guy couldn't be worse than the previous pair... Mm.
Gary Neville couldn't be worse probably than the previous pair.
Yeah, true. A new owner may want his own manager, of course, in which case it would be bad news for Roy Hodgson, although apparently he does have something written into his contract that he will benefit financially to a very large degree, should that be the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the offer on the table is for $3 million, which...
$300 million.
$300 million, which would clear most of their debt.
Mm.
But and that would result in Hicks and Gillette making a huge loss.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have an overdraft with which to buy players, and then it would depend on, you know, they need to get rid of the Christian Poulsens and whatnots that are currently clogging up the dressing room. Their team just isn't up to scratch. A lot of it's been blamed on the fact that they're struggling to perform because of the off-field shenanigans, but I don't believe that for a minute. I just don't think they're any good.
Well, there's talk of Man City coming in for Fernando Torres again in January. It'd be interesting to see, because I think the way he is at the moment, if City do offer $60 million or something for him, I think they should sell him.
Mm.
I was roundly scoffed at pre-season pod for saying that Torres would be gone by Christmas. I still think he will, though. I think the most interesting thing to come out of Liverpool this season, or this week, was the viral video that went around.
Can it be a coincidence that straight after that reached YouTube, Hicks and Gillette found themselves out, or potentially out?
Yeah, I mean, well, it was always going to work. It was organised by Mike Jeffries, who's the British screenwriter who's responsible for the Goal trilogy.
The internationally recognised Goal trilogy. Which was your favourite of the three Goal films?
I haven't seen any of them.
Tom?
Definitely two.
Have you seen all three?
Yep.
No, you haven't.
I've seen bits of all three.
Have you? Paul Doyle, have you seen the Goal trilogy?
No.
No. All right, then. Anyway, back to his latest production.
It's the fourth installment of the Goal trilogy. It's for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's called Thank You, Mr. Hicks, and it features a load of...
Oh, it's dripping with irony, that, isn't it?
Load of Liverpoolian celebrities and some people who aren't celebrities and some people who might be celebrities, but you can't really remember who they are. But
Craig from Big Brother.
Yeah. I mean, Liverpool fans have every right to protest, but... And they should protest if they're unhappy with the owners. But it's the really half-arsed nature of their protest that gets on my goat. We've had these marches, you know, from the pub they were going to be in anyway to the match they were going to anyway. So it's just totally ineffectual. And now you have this viral video which features, you know, Ian McCulloch from Echo and the Bunnyman.
Shouldn't it be a Wirral video?
John Power from The Laz, Ricky Tomlinson from The Royal Family, who would say the moon was made of cabbage if he thought to sell a few more copies of his DVD. Ditto for...
What do you think would be a more effective protest?
Well, I've said before, the way to get rid of Hicks and Gillette is to stop going to matches. If there are 50,000 empty seats at Anfield, then no one's going to buy overpriced burgers, overpriced programmes, overpriced beer. overpriced replica shirts. That was a huge irony of that video, that a lot of the people who appeared in it were wearing replica shirts, which they paid for, the proceeds of which had gone into the pockets of Gillette and Hicks.
Mm. Well, he basically...
Ian McCulloch was absolutely priceless, because he was shambling and shuffling along wearing this grotty parka and saying, likening what they'd done to the club to the rape of someone's family.
Mm.
And it's kind of fitting that McCulloch was there, because, like Liverpool, he too was magnificent in the 80s, but now he's just a relic that everyone laughs at.
Well, Barry, you're on a roll here, aren't you?
I feel strongly about it.
Right.
But, you know, we can discuss it more in Liverpool in a week and a half's time.
Yeah, absolutely. In the meantime, no irony there in you having your rant about the Liverpool fans, rant about things that they're ranting about. There you go. Excellent. That's probably it for part one, listeners. In part two, it's David Conn.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
And listeners will be interested to know that producer Andy will be posting a link on the Football Weekly page to that viral video. It'll be interesting to see, maybe listeners could have a competition as to how many minutes they can stomach. I think the full thing, Barry, is
6.5 minutes of the most sanctimonious horseshit you'll ever hear in your life.
I think I lasted about 3, which I was quite proud of. Did you make it all the way?
I've watched it twice.
No.
Yeah.
Anyway, David Conn, Barry... Yeah, David Conn is on the line.
I am.
Hi, David. Thank you for your patience. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm a bit frazzled by the fact that one of Hicks and Gillette's other crimes is that they don't seem to understand the time difference that we have between ourselves and America. And they released their statement the other night at, I think it was 1 o'clock in the morning, which was pretty handy for... writing it all up carefully and responsibly. But having said that, Liverpool released their statement, which first said they'd agreed a sale and the owners were being obstructive. And I think that was at 10:30 at night. So we've had some late nights with it all.
Well, where are we now, David?
I do find it an absolutely fascinating story. It's very dramatic, and it's going to court. One of the really interesting things about it is the way Broughton came out so publicly yesterday, as one of our other Guardian colleagues described it, with a gun in each hand, you know, and he'd been really quiet, and all we'd had was this picture of him with his, sober suit on, and suddenly to come out and be so vocal, and basically confirming everything that him, Christian Perslow, and Ian Eyre, the three other directors who don't own the club, they are absolutely and 100% at war with Hicks and Gillette, and Broughton, you know, the things he was saying for the chairman of a club to say about the owner of the club, you know, they've flagrantly abused the agreements that they made, they've done everything to prevent a sale, they could have gone with their heads held high, but now, you know, they've got no credibility, you know, things like this. He's sort of come out and said after nearly 6 months of silence, and now it's going to court, which we think will be next week, to where a judge will declare whether those three, as the majority on the board, have the right to insist on this sale to the new American owners, or whether Hicks and Gillette have got some right to defend it and claim that as the owners they can oppose the sale.
David, what's he going to say though? What's he going to say? Is he going to say Hicks and Gillette or Broughton and Co?
Do you know what, James? Even in this situation,
yeah.
I hate speculating. I really do. Because you know, let's follow it and let's see. What I'm saying is Martin Broughton says he's got all the cards. He's got them tied up with legal agreements.
And Hicks and Gillette say the same thing.
Hicks says that he's going to defend it, right? But at the moment, what he's saying, the way in which he's saying he's going to defend it doesn't make sense, except
right.
that he's just saying, I never gave those undertakings. I don't know about this constitution that means we can't change the board, right? So if that's his case, then, look, I don't know, because I haven't seen all the documents, I haven't been inside the rooms, and some whiskery judge in the wood-panelled, dark, gothic halls of the High Court on the Strand will make his whiskery mind up next week.
All right, wearing suspenders underneath it all, probably.
What if it's a woman judge?
Yeah.
Well, yes, it's quite unlikely to be, but she may well be wearing suspenders as well.
Yep.
And whiskers.
We'll have to see.
We'll have to see. All right, then. Well, listen, Dave, you have been working very, very hard, because besides all this excitement at Anfield, you've also been granted exclusive behind-the-scenes access to the amazing project currently underway there at Manchester City. Now, amongst the many things that the top folk at Man City divulged to you was the fact that they're not going to go crazy spending money anymore. Those days are over. They're going to be fiscally responsible. Are we supposed to believe this?
We are. We're supposed to believe it. Yeah. I believe that what they're saying is they're not saying they're not going to spend money anymore. What they're saying is that they've assembled a squad that they are broadly happy with. So they're not going to be signing like six players in the transfer window like they did this summer. And I mean, you do lose track, but it was definitely four in that first January, which is when they signed Nigel de Jong, Bellamy, Given and Wayne Bridge. You know, they have bought a new squad. There's not that many that are playing that were there when they took over. And what they're saying is, and squads can only be 25 men now, can't they? And they've also got UEFA's financial fair play rules, which suddenly the big clubs, it's like the pennies just suddenly dropped, that they've got these rules which broadly require them to break even, not be making huge losses, even if you've got an owner that's prepared to fund them. And that starts next year. And so City is saying, we're not going to be chucking loads of money at signing players. Of course, they've got a massive wage bill, so it doesn't mean that there's multi millions that they're not going to be spending, but that they're going to be reining in buying new players, and that they're going to be concentrating on the team that they've got, trying to gel and, you know, win things or be successful at least. And then they're spending a hell of a lot on the academy and hoping that they can produce young players eventually to come through to replace what Paul Hayward fantastically described the other week as the wardrobe-like Yaya Toure and other, you know, high-earning senior players.
David, I personally find City quite dull to watch, the games I've seen them play recently. And I also think there's a certain perverse pleasure to be had from supporting a team that's actually not very good. And I have this theory that a lot of Manchester City fans are possibly hankering after the days when their team was a bit of a joke and just, you know, shambling like drunks from one catastrophe to the next. Is that a feeling you'd get at all, or do you think that all the fans are happy that this Arab has arrived with, or this Sheikh has arrived with all his multi-billions?
Now, I actually think that that's a very valid way of looking at City, but I think people who think that the fans liked it when the club was lurching from one catastrophe to another have always slightly got City wrong, right? What you've got to remember is City fans, a very, very large proportion of City fans are sort of 30 and 40 somethings and older, who grew up as kids with City as one of the top clubs in the country. You know, in the early to late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, they remember when United got relegated after Dennis Law for City back-heeled, you know, that goal that sent United down. And amongst all these catastrophes, honestly, there's been a huge yearning for and belief that City are in reality a top club. And, there's been some gallows humour about it all. You know, we're not really here and all that. But I think there's been a great yearning and a belief that City's a top club, because that's where they were when everyone was when people were growing up. And so another element to it all is that Sheikh Mansour's investment, of course, it's huge money, and the players are getting paid wages which are pretty much obscene, especially in a place like East Manchester, and that's football for you, right? But at City, the fans, first of all, they kind of think, well, United have had all this money all this time, and you know, that's the only way to get success. And they do want to have success, Barry. You know, that there's not that many that want that sort of comfort zone of being sort of lovable of lovable failure.
David, listeners were very excited that you were coming on the show.
James, you are so full of flattery. I really must talk to you more often. You've given me a house point for working hard, and now you're telling me that people are... And at this point, while we're talking about listeners, would you mind if I just gave a mention to my nephew, Tom?
Your nephew, Tom?
Yeah.
In
Barcelona.
Is he in Barcelona?
Yeah, and he was telling me at the weekend, and now everyone's going to think that you guys have set this up for me to say this, but he was honestly and truthfully telling me at the weekend, he's 28, he loves football, he teaches English in Barcelona, and he was telling me that he always gets the pod downloaded to him, and he listens to it on his way to work on the train from Barcelona to the town that he works in, and you guys talk at just the right length for his train journey, and he thinks you're all great.
Comes into the station, then let's get on to listener's question to you. Pipov says, in order to get around Platini's new anti-sugar daddy finance regulations, what is to stop City's owners transferring large revenue generating assets onto Man City's books, e.g. an oil well? What about it, eh?
Yeah, well, I know people are already saying, what about this and what about that? And I can tell you that I'm sad enough and miserable enough to have UEFA's financial fair play rules on my desk. And they're 85 pages long, and they're actually quite impressive. And they have thought of all that. They're not just, it's not just a Michel Platini, two-page rule. They've thought of everything. They've got financial experts at UEFA, working within UEFA. They've got a guy who worked for Deloitte in Geneva working. I think he's head of licensing, club licensing at UEFA, who's pretty much drafted the rules. And they do say that a club has to live within the means, within its income. And if suddenly Abu Dhabi Tourism Authority, which is actually one of City's sponsors, decides to sponsor City to the tune of £100 million a year, then UEFA can say that's clearly not market value and it's not real, genuine.
In that case, Balboa asks, if they fail to meet these criteria, do you really think UEFA will have the balls to ban they or any other club from European competition?
That is the interesting question, and that's like who's going to win in court next week, you know. And again, being a bottler, it's hard to predict. But if I can just say what the politics are, the politics are that UEFA doesn't want to ban clubs that have qualified for its competitions on playing merit, right? And there are some, there's wriggle room which says, you know, if you're moving towards breaking even and you're obviously responsible. So you're not a Portsmouth or a Real Mallorca, which is the example that they always give, which also went bust. But you're more of a City where you've obviously got solid backing and a solid business plan, but you're just massively overspending, right? You're a separate case. But... the rules have been brought in to stop massive overspending. They are serious about it. And if they just wave clubs through that are massively in breach of it, they've got no credibility whatsoever. Mm. So UEFA are going to have to find a way to show they're being firm, but without banning every club. And it's not just Manchester City. It's also, you know, United can make losses because of the Glazer debts. Inter Milan made a massive loss. Barca, that everyone wants to watch all over Europe, made a massive loss. So UEFA have got a difficult job in deciding how they're going to enforce those rules, but they just cannot, do nothing.
All right. Well, interesting. It's an interesting potential question marks over Platini's future in charge of UEFA if he were to rub the big clubs up the wrong way in real terms, as opposed to just to, you know, with words. But here's a question from Mr. Gareth East. It's a question for David Conn. Being the expert on all things financial, do you have an overdraft? Second question, do you ever get asked questions on the pod about actual players' performances and the merits of wing-backs over a flat-back four? And three, what's your favourite goal ever, 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 David?
Right, I've forgotten the first question.
The
now,
first
James.
One is, do you have an overdraft? I think that was just a bit of cheekiness from Gareth E. But his point is, what about the football, David? What's your favourite goal ever?
Favourite goal ever? Well, I do quite like watching Carlos Alberto's fourth goal in the 1970 World Cup. I find it difficult to stop watching Pelé's layoff for that goal. The Dalglish, Kenny Dalglish coming back in the news, I wrote a piece about why the Liverpool fans are chanting for Dalglish, and it reminded me of that goal he won to win the European Cup in, was it 1978, against Bruges, where he just dinked it over the keeper, and wasn't that his first season at Liverpool? That was quite a choice one that's been in my mind this week. Do I get asked about the football?
Not
very
enough.
Much, but
no.
As someone who used to have to play fullback for school and club when the other midfield players were more skillful than me. I do like an overlapping fullback.
Oh.
Or, who of course we have to call a wing back now.
David, I played as a fullback for Burr Town in my youth, and yeah. I was never allowed to cross the halfway line by my manager.
And how frustrating was that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you something.
Where's the satisfaction in it? I mean, a sliding tackle, okay. Clearance off the line, that was a bit of glory in that. But really, the glory for a fullback is getting forward and crossing it and someone else scoring, isn't it?
That's why I get upset at the moment with all this whinging and moaning about rough tackles, because that's all I had as a player.
Yeah, yeah.
Crunching challenges and yellow cards.
Were you a hard-nosed enforcer, David, in your school defence?
No, that's the point. Oh. You know, it was the defending bit of playing in defence that I didn't like.
Right.
You know, I liked you know, being the kind of the Kaiser of Bury.
Right. Listen, David, that was fantastic. Thank you very much for all of that.
Thanks very much, and thanks for
Shout out to your nephew there.
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Fantastic stuff. David Conn, everybody, there in Manchester, very much on the front line, I like to think. It is a bit of a front line. They may be second in the table above United, but it's not exclusively a happy camp there where it is they train. I can't remember the name of the training ground.
The Man City training ground.
The Man
ground.
City training ground, that's the one. You've got your Tevez Mancini thing.
I wouldn't be too bothered about that.
How hard is he? He's taken on Craig Bellamy, Carlos Tevez and David Moyes in the last 6 months or so.
But I don't think there's a problem with Tevez getting angry about the way they're playing.
You don't?
I think it's more of a problem if you're someone like Rubinho and you just don't turn up and eventually have to flounce off to
another
club.
Does it not speak of a kind of undercurrent of dissent?
It doesn't look like it's out of control yet. I think if this thing carries on, then it's a problem. But at the moment, I think it's just someone who cares about the club, and it doesn't seem to be affecting his form on the field either.
No, that's true.
Were you saying to me this morning that you have a deep throat in the Man City dressing room?
I have deep throats pretty much all over, but the one who is in the...
And he said the players all hate Mancini. Is that right?
He did seem to feel, from his own contacts within the Eastland setup, that Mancini is deeply unpopular because he doesn't speak to any of the players, and he is constantly changing the schedule without giving the players notice. And also his insistence on doing things like building hills for them to run up and having twice daily sessions and all that kind of thing. And that is why he felt that the minute results didn't start to go their way, that the whole thing would implode. As indeed Emmanuel Samba said, you can't buy team spirit. De Jong, quick mention on that. A lot of people posting in us a bit. HK1234 pointing out the irony of Dutch manager Bert van Marwijk dropping De Jong for crossing the line with this tackle, but maintaining Van Bommel in the team, the dirtiest player at the World Cup, who just happens to be his son-in-law. Paul, I was hoping to excite you with that topic.
No, I mean, he's just made a scapegoat of De Jong, hasn't he? And he was heavily criticised after the World Cup because of the brutal way that Holland played, and now this is a chance for him to show that he intends to change. Whether he does or not, we'll see.
Yeah, did you see the reaction, though, in the Dutch press and television? De Jong was labelled a criminal and a disgrace and the shame of Dutch football.
Yeah, same in France, where the referee was widely lambasted for not even giving him a yellow card for the tackle.
Right.
I honestly didn't think it was that bad a tackle. I'm not just saying that to be contrary. I genuinely thought it was an okay tackle. Mm. But I've a good stat for you here, actually. Sure. Van Bommel is, I know it's early in the group stages, but Van Bommel is the second most fouled player in the Euro qualifier so far. He's been fouled 11 times.
Who's the most fouled?
The Emre from Turkey.
Two very, very popular players then. Anyway, there you go, Man City, for all the potential points of friction, etc., they are up in second place, and that's where we'd leave the Premier League for the moment, because in part three we're going to be attacking the exciting world of Euro qualifiers. If you're excited by what they're saying in other countries, and I know I am, then you might like to look out for my European paper review, which will be up on Friday morning at the Guardian website. There you go. And every Friday. It's contractual, unfortunately. Now,
I'm sure you're rewarded handsomely.
You would be surprised, Barry Glendinning. I get to keep the papers. That's pretty much some of them. Anyway, European qualifiers. England don't have one until next week when they'll be playing Montenegro. But there has been exciting news in the meantime. Firstly, that the FA were warbling on about Steve McLaren being a valid candidate to take over from Fabio Capello, which I think is absolutely fair, although it did raise some surprising controversy in other quarters, Paul.
Yeah, it is fair. He's done a good job since being dismissed by England. Mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't exactly warbling on about him. They were asked, would they consider, would he be in the running?
Right.
And they can't very well say, absolutely not.
Oh, right. So, is that all it was? Yeah. Okay, what about Kevin Davis then, making the squad at 33?
Well, Kevin Davis is my favourite player in the Premier League because he just makes me laugh.
Ah, because why? In a nice way, is it?
I love his statistics. Ah. I love the fact that he, for six of the last seven seasons, he's committed more fouls than anyone else in the Premier League. And the one season, the one person who interrupted his reign was John Carew in his first season in the Premier League. And Davis responded the following season by committing more fouls than anyone else in the history of the Premier League.
Right, he upped his game.
Yeah, and he's already well on target to keep his title this season.
If I'm not very much mistaken, Davis sort of made his name playing for Chesterfield during their great cup run when they should have got to the FA Cup final. Middlesbrough robbed them in the semi, but he had pace then, and there was more to his game than just leaping in the air with elbows.
He was known as a very skillful player, and he scored a brilliant goal when he was playing for Southampton. I remember him running half the length of the pitch and chipping, and it was when he got a bad injury, and after that he kind of transformed himself into this just big bloke.
He was the man who cost Roy Hodgson, basically. Well, not that wasn't the only factor, but Roy Hodgson signed him for $7.5 million when he was at Blackburn, and he didn't score a single goal, I think. Oh. But the thing about his fouls, of course, that's interesting and that may have put off England managers in the past is just that if he gets that many free kicks awarded against him in the Premier League at international level, when there's referees who are not even as lenient as Martin Atkinson and co, will he just constantly give the ball away to the opposition via free kicks?
Fair point. England, anyway, aren't playing at all next week, so we'll have the opportunity to discuss Fabio Capello's exciting lineup in Monday's pod. Other home nations and Ireland are in action. Ireland, top of Group B, of course. They've got a big game against Russia, who slumped to a 1-0 home loss to Slovakia last time out. Big game this in Dublin. Hey, Barry and Paul. Paul, apparently. Barry's pointing at you. I can't imagine why. Is it anything to do with that empty page in front of you with Ireland Russia notes written at the top of it?
Yeah.
Okay, Paul.
I am pleased to see that Seamus Coleman has been called up, could earn his first cap, and it will solve a bit of a problem for us if he does start, because he'll more than likely start a right back, which will enable maybe John O'Shea to go to left back, which means that Kevin Kilbane can take a well-earned rest, and I'm sure all the team will be grateful for that.
All right, well, let's move on anyway to Northern Ireland, who have a big clash with Italy. Northern Ireland, as you no doubt know, lying third in the group, but having only played one game, which they won 1-0 away to Slovenia, World Cup's Slovenia. So really impressive stuff from Northern Ireland.
Yeah, it is very impressive.
Very
it's
impressive.
Good result for them.
They have got to be per head of population.
Yeah.
Well, the best country in the world in terms of
what's the population in Northern Ireland?
Well, it's about 1 million, but they consistently beat teams that really they should never ever beat.
Well, Italy, who are coming off of a really horrible World Cup, as everybody knows, have had two wins so far. They beat Estonia in Estonia, and then won against the Faroe Islands. Well done for that. I don't know that they are, despite that, looking all that solid. New manager in charge, Cesare Prandelli. But he is still very much tinkering with his system. A lot of changes in the lineup. He's called up some fresh players for this one. It does look like a good side. But, you know, as you say, we've seen other big nations and big names go to Northern Ireland and come away
Windsor Park is a horrible place to have to play for a visiting team. You know, it's very small, very passionate support. It's a bit of a dump, to be honest. But, you know, Northern Ireland have had some extraordinary results there in the past, and with a not particularly good Italian side visiting this weekend, there's no reason why they shouldn't do so again.
On the subject of Italy, actually, Zambrotta has made the call up, and this you're saying not a very good Italy side. Prandelli, you were saying, I haven't got any other options. I'm really disappointed at the quality of player in the Italian league. There's not the talent that I need for this team. which is a bit worrying, really, isn't it? Also in Italian news, of course, at the training ground this week, Federico Macheda calling Wayne Rooney a chav, in an affectionate way. Rooney's a bit of a chav, he informed good-naturedly Italian reporters, who promptly put it on the front page of the Gazzetta.
What's chav in Italian?
Quata. Ah. Or quato. Sorry, I'm giving a chavette. But anyway.
Do you know, it's against Guardian protocol to use the word chav. I think we'd get away with it in here.
In this case. All right. Well, we're outside legal jurisdiction.
In our pod.
On the subject of Italy, if I can just... I'm doing a little thing tomorrow because I thought it would be interesting to speak to people from some of the minnow nations and what it's like to... Italy not being one of them, but I spoke to some people from Malta, and who I think are the lowest ranked team in Europe, and they in a bid to try and regularly play against better opposition and improve their own performances. There were talks afoot there. They're not very optimistic of it bearing fruit, but it shows at least what's in their mind of entering a Malta national team in one of the Italian lower leagues and seeing if they can make their way up to Serie A.
That's a fascinating idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jimbo's still angry with Malta because he broke his toe there.
Yeah. I did, but I fractured it.
I mean, they do another sport. I think the British basketball team at the moment, as they prepare for the London Olympics, I think they're in the Dutch league or something.
I think?
I may have just dreamt that, but somebody who knows something about basketball can check that out.
Are Malta not... did they not do a number on us once?
Well,
the Republic of Ireland.
I don't remember them actually beating us. Our record victory is against Malta, but no, they're not. I think in the last World Cup,
to be worse than them in Europe.
They didn't score even a goal in the qualifiers.
They had some lovely crosses.
They're beneath Luxembourg and Liechtenstein.
Anyway, Scotland, who you've probably also been interviewing on them. No, I'm joking, listeners. They are top of the group. Here's me laughing. Thanks to that brave 0-0 draw away at Lithuania and the dramatic victory in the 97th minute at home to Liechtenstein. But they do face a tough game this weekend when they visit the Czech Republic, who themselves are seeking to collect their first points.
Well, they lost to Lithuania as well.
At home, yeah.
So maybe they're not the Czech Republic team that once was, but... then again, Liechtenstein weren't supposed to be any good, and they still press Scotland. And also, Scotland are top of that group because a few teams have got games in hand as well. Yeah. So.
All right, then. Shasha Mamakaka says, why is Ian Holloway more popular than Jesus Christ this week? Christ fed the 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fishes, but Holloway satisfied millions with 11 tangerines, this following the result at Anfield. And H. Lemons Glenn says, greatest goal ever scored. Search the YouTube for Glen Torren 1, Porter Down 0. Matty Burrow's sensational injury time goal, which earned the Carling Premiership leaders Glen Torren a dramatic and fortunate victory over Porter Down at the Oval. Barry, you saw this. Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
Oh, all right.
You were telling me about it.
I was telling you about it. Well, I did. I think we kind of got sidetracked by explaining to Tom Lutz the merits of Abbott and Costello, who's on first, which, unbelievably, listeners, Tom Lutz had never, ever, ever watched. You've seen it now, Tom.
It was very good.
It is very good.
It will also be featuring in Friday's Joy of Six.
Joy of Six,
anyone
Barry,
who hasn't
about what?
Seen it. I'll just keep it as a surprise, but Abbott and Costello's Who's on First is in it.
All right. Hard to think of a comic conceit more perfect than that sketch. Other Euro qualifiers, very briefly then, as we spiral towards the conclusion of today's Football Weekly Extra. France, they're in real trouble, although they did get that win away to Bosnia, didn't they?
They did.
Mm. Who are they playing this time?
Romania at the weekend. And Laurent Blanc has brought in somebody who in the French press, anyway, is being described almost in the same terms that Eileen Drury was under Glenn Hoddle. This is an attempt to psychologically boost the French players. On the pitch, it looks like he's going to start with Nasri and Gourcouf, which a lot of people said two playmakers couldn't play together. But so it'll be interesting to see if he does start firstly with them and secondly whether it works.
A lot of players turning up late for the call up. No, and he said, was he going to take disciplinary measures against them? He said, we've already suspended half our available players. We can't shoot ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, on the subject of disciplinary measures, there also recently the fallout from what happened in the World Cup is still going on. And La Parisienne printed during the week some of the excerpts that they got hold of, the interviews that the players gave with the authorities explaining their case, and quite an interesting picture of how it all unfolded there. The strike wasn't quite the united action that it was portrayed as at the time by through the statements that the players released. For Djibril Cisse, for example, apparently went absolutely crazy at the idea of a strike. He was there, you know, he's worked his way back from two horrendous injuries to get a chance to play at the World Cup, and now his own teammates are sabotaging it. So he was apparently in tears and everything when the suggestion of striking was put to him. And Thierry Henry was opposed to it as well, but decided not to intervene because no one came to his aid when he was being criticised for the handball.
Yeah, fair point, Thierry.
We should probably mention Wales-Bulgaria just to keep our Welsh listeners happy.
Yep.
John Tatrick's gone, Brian Flynn's in. I mean, Wales are a bit of a shambles at the moment, and they might get a good result here or there. They're in England's group, that's two big games for them, but it's pretty long shot that they're going to get anywhere near a sniff of qualifying.
They are at home to Bulgaria on Friday. Interesting. Lying third in the group as well, so there you go. With no points. Right. That's it.
Who's beneath them? Because even by alphabetical order...
Switzerland and Bulgaria.
They have minus goal difference or something.
Well, yeah. Bulgaria have played two matches, scored none and conceded five, so they're bottom of the group. Switzerland have a goal difference of minus two from their one game so far, and Wales have a goal difference of minus one. So
Wales could actually beat Bulgaria. Bulgaria seem to be in an awful lot of
from that
mess.
Information that I've just given you, yeah.
No, but just going on my listening to Jonathan Wilson talking about them and infighting and mess, big mess. So, yeah, it's a good chance for Wales to...
And, of course, no Berbatov these days.
No.
He is Bulgarian, isn't he?
Yes. He is, yeah, yes.
Good. There you go. Excellent. All right, then. That's today's Football Weekly Extra. And we'll be back with Football Weekly Classic Edition on Monday morning, rounding up all the qualifiers, looking forward to more qualifiers and finding some other potentially more interesting things to talk about as well. Many thanks in the meantime to Paul Doyle, Tom Lutz and Barry Glendening for joining us today. You at home for being the reason that we put the whole thing together, and Andy Duckworth, of course, our producer. We'll see you on Monday. Have a lovely weekend.
I wanted to say to Tom X, imagine if your family, which is what Liverpool Football Club is to most people, especially the real fans who go home and away, it's their family. It's like you're raping all of them at once over a long period of time and getting away with it.
Debt, the problems at the club, on the field, off the field, and it's all down to you.
This is not working. Give us it back.
You lied.
Promised us everything.
It looked good when you came in, but you've broken all the promises.
No credibility, no integrity, no morals, and basically no money.
It's not worth whatever money you make.
The only way you'd ever understand it, how much we not feel about this club, is if someone came to your house and burnt it down.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.